Today's episode, If You Could Hide to Kolob, is brought to you by Missionary Journal by My Give Back Books. The Missionary Journal is a guided journal which will help you remember all your favorite missionary moments and all the special times you had. Search Missionary Journal on Amazon now or check the links on If You Could Hide to Kolob Facebook pages. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode If You Could Hide to Kolob podcast. My name's Daniel. This is my brother, Clive.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a great episode. I'm really excited for this one. We're getting into a lot of, there's a lot. There's what, six chapters today, Daniel?
Clive, there is. Abinadi is such a great topic, and it does go for a while, so we actually do have quite a bit to get through. I've got a quote to start us off with. I might just get into that, and then we can just get straight into Abinadi.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is from Thomas S. Monson in a talk he gave called He is Risen. I have read and I believe the testimonies of those who experienced the grief of Christ's crucifixion and the joy of his resurrection. I have read and I believe the testimonies of those in the New World who were visited by the same risen Lord. I believe the testimony of one who, in this dispensation, spoke with the Father and the Son in a grove now called sacred, and who gave his life, sealing that testimony with his blood. Clive, Abinadi seals his testimony with his blood. And there's a couple of things I wanted to make mention here before we go into it of just how special Abinadi is. And I'm not sure if everyone is able to make this link. But what's happening at the moment is the plates, as we know, get kind of passed around a little bit. King Benjamin has made his speech. And now Ammon's come across this record. But why is it so special? Well, Abinadi, as we'll see in next week's episode, because of what the message he gave, there's one person called Alma, listens to Abinadi, believes what he says, and then goes away. Why does that matter? Well, Alma goes on to have a son called Alma, who has a son called Helaman, and Shiblon, and Helaman, and Nephi, Amos. All these people become the recorders of all the way to the end of the Book of Mormon. Perhaps Mormon was a relation to Alma as well. I guess we'll never know that. But it's because of Abinadi's message. From here, there's a genealogical straight pathway from Alma to the end. And it's because Abinadi was so good in his messaging that he was able to get through to someone. He had long passed when Alma eventually was able to start baptizing people. And Abinadi perhaps never had a clue that Alma had listened to him and took his words on board, took his advice on board, and left the wicked King Noah. So just something I thought I'd just point out there of just how special is Abinadi? Well, his wording is special. His knowledge of the gospel is special. And the long-lasting effect he has on the Book of Mormon is very special.
So let's dive straight into it. So there's such a huge difference here than what we talked about last week. So last week we talked about Zeniff, how he came to this land and they were one of the crew that left Zarahemla to repopulate the land of Nephi again. And Zeniff was,
they called Lehi Nephi, didn't they?
They called it Lehi Nephi, and it's flip-flops around for quite a bit until they finally settle on Lehi Nephi. So,
right.
Yeah, it can be a bit confusing for a while. But yeah, Zeniff, he comes here, he decides he wants to be peaceful with the Lamanites and gets the land that way instead of going to war. And people start praising God and do all these different things. But then he dies and he passes on his reign to one of his sons. He's got a few sons, one of his sons named Noah. Now, King Noah, complete opposite. King Noah is a man that's explained that he walked in the desire of his own heart. That's the type of person that we're dealing with. Instead of a God-fearing, people-loving man.
That's the headline. The desires of his own heart. And that's almost summarizing to me. If someone's the desires of their own heart, they have no desire to worry about what anyone else wants.
Yeah, that's right. It's all about him. You know, Jacob spoke of one of the worst things that he had to speak of, that he was so embarrassed about. where the people had many wives and concubines. But straight away, Noah had many wives and concubines, and he told his people that there was okay for them to have many wives and concubines. Then he made taxes that was, you know, again, very different to what Jacob or even King Benjamin was speaking of, you know, that they didn't want to tax the people. So he made taxes there to tax 1/5 part of all that they had to support himself and his priests. He got rid of all of his father's priests, and he decided to bring his own ones in who supported what's described as his laziness, idolatry, and whoredoms.
There's one thing that you just mentioned there that I just don't want to skip past. I thought I would ask you there in when I was doing my own bit of research here. So he, in verse 3, so we're at chapter 11, verse 3, and he laid a tax of 1/5 part of their, of all they possessed, 1/5 part of their gold, 1/5 part of their silver, and 1/5 part of their ziff, copper, brass, iron, fatlings, 1/5 of their grain, everything they had. What is ziff?
You know, it's funny you say that, actually, because surprisingly, this is something that came up a lot on my mission. People that didn't believe the Book of Mormon, that had actually read it, one of their biggest hangups was ziff, which at the time surprised me because I've always just read it and just believed it was something, some kind of precious metal.
And there's something in the footnote down there, so it's not like we've got no clue. But do you have more of an idea than that?
Yeah, well, the footnote, yeah, says shining to overlay plate with metal. That's as far as we understand it. But looking into the type of thing that ziff could be. So there is a Hebrew word that's spelt Z-I-Y-V that could be interpreted or spoken as ziff, you know?
Yeah.
But we know that the language, and we've spoken about this a few times, the language has evolved. So the people are speaking in terms of ways that they have changed the language. Even now, languages evolved. Back then, languages evolved. Maybe ziff and ziff were the same thing. So this Hebrew Z-I-Y-F did mean brightness or shining. So it's a very similar thing to what the footnotes actually say. People will ask, well, okay, well, if Joseph Smith interpreted the Book of Mormon, why didn't he interpret the word ziff? Why didn't he interpret to say gold and silver and bright and shining metals? Well, I mean, there's a few things here we don't know exactly, but maybe Joseph Smith just understood the word ziff to be what it says.
Maybe he knew.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe he just didn't recognize what it meant and just kept it in there. Who knows? But all we know is it's something that is, I mean, the Book of Mormon is true, but it's something that I know we'll eventually figure out. But it's just an interesting, it's such a small detail that it's such a big hang up for people.
Well, I'm glad I asked because I hadn't looked at it that much at all. So you were saying that King Noah had chosen his own priests. And there's a bit of a description on them, isn't there? Yea, and they also became idolatrous because they were deceived by the vain and flattering words of the kings and priests, for they did speak flattering things unto them. Now, the reason I wanted to mention that specifically is because Alma, who we are going to talk about in next week's Come Follow Me, Alma's being described here as one. Alma is one of these priests. And at this point in time, he's lazy. He's idolatrous. He's not a very nice person, but he does become a great man. And I just wanted to put that in there. We won't talk about Alma again now, but I just wanted to drop that in there, that this is part of Alma's character and the great change we see in someone who becomes an absolute incredible missionary in the church doesn't start off in the greatest of positions. And it's probably just an example for everyone out there.
Yeah, it's a good point because it just shows the spirit of the things that we're going to get into, the spirit that is with Abinadi. So yeah, King Noah, he has all these priests, they're all lazy and idolatrous. And the people work hard because they think, well, the king is the king and he's done these things and we must do these things. It goes on to explain that he builds these elegant and spacious buildings and he decorates the buildings with gold and silver and precious things. He even makes a palace with big seats for him and his priests, and they were made of gold and silver, and they were put in a specific way that they could look down to the people. So they wanted to elevate themselves and show, well, we are better. We are the kings. We are the priests. We're the ones that look over this city. So there's, I mean, again, just a huge difference. He even builds a tower, right, that looks over a place called Shemlon. So they're in a place called Shillom, but there's a place called Shemlon where the Lamanites dwelt. And this tower was able to look over to see the Lamanites. I guess maybe in King Noah's way, he's gone, well, not only am I going to look over my people, but I'm going to show the Lamanites how good I am that I could even see them and their area.
Right.
You know, it's such a huge difference between the two kings.
And it talks about how did he fund all this? He funded it with the taxes. He was a, because of the taxing of the people is how he was able to get all these things he needed. And it says at the end of 13, and thus he did do with the riches which he had obtained by the taxation of people. And it came to pass, this is 14, that he placed his heart upon riches, and he spent his time in riotous living with his wives and his concubines. And so did all the priests spend their time with harlots. It's this next verse, Clive, in number 15 that I've got highlighted in my scriptures. He's a drunk. He goes through a huge amount of trouble to make sure he's got endless supplies of wine. It came to pass that he planted vineyards round about in the land. I'm not a real green thumb, but I'm assuming it takes a fair bit of time to grow some grapes and to get the land good enough that good grapes can grow and you can use the grapes to make good drink. But he planted vineyards in the land and he built wine presses. So he was producing. He didn't build a personal wine press for him and is one bottle at home for himself. He built wine presses and made wine in abundance. And therefore he became a wine bibber. And also his people, they were drunks. Like, they loved to party. They loved to hang out with the women, the wives, the concubines, and just sit around and drink all day while the people worked. They essentially worked so that they could pay taxes. To your point earlier, this is a big difference to his, the way his father operated.
Even in his sort of military mindset. So the next thing it talks about is that Lamanites came and to attack the people. And again, we talked about this last week, you know, the Lamanites sort of have this plan where they're going to attack people in the fields first. And that's what they do.
Yep.
And when King Noah found out about this, he sent some people, all right, fine, just go and defend it. You can see in verse 17, the laziness of King Noah. Says, and King Noah sent guards round about the land to keep them off, but he did not send a sufficient number, and the Lamanites came upon them and killed them. So it's just sort of King Noah going, fine, just go take care of it. You know, not a, well, I need to protect my people, just more of a, fine, go sort it out. And he just didn't send enough, and that they got killed as well.
What's your thoughts on the text in terms of the text takes time to describe King Noah? There's a lot of doctrine in the Book of Mormon, and only some of it, you know, we've talked about on this podcast, okay, those three verses are this, those two verses are this. All of this that you're talking about here, that, you know, in 17 as well, with him being lazy and only sending a few people to try and kill the Lamanites, like, there's a good 17 verses taken out to describe what King Noah's like. Is it that important to the story for us to understand King Noah as well as we now do?
Yeah, I guess it puts more pressure on the Abinadi part, going, well, how would anybody be able to stand up to such a person when he's convinced the people that wickedness is good and it's okay and that he is greater than anyone? So I guess it's really just building the character of King Noah to help us understand the strength, the spiritual strength of Abinadi.
Just how big of a deal it was for Abinadi to do that by himself.
Exactly, yeah.
Hmm. Interesting. In the next part here, King Noah is now bragging in 19. And now because of this great victory, they were lifted up in the pride of their hearts. They did boast in their own strength, saying that their 50 could stand against thousands of the Lamanites. And thus they did boast. And I've got this bit highlighted in my scriptures. And did delight in blood. Okay. It did delight in blood and the shedding of the blood of their brethren. So they delighted in blood. And then they also delighted in the shedding of blood. So it's like just a double. It's a double dose of wickedness. And they delighted in the shedding the blood of their brethren. And this and it all goes back to the kings and the priests. And this because of the wickedness of their kings and priests. It's a real example. The king and the priests, they're the ecclesiastical leaders of the land. They're the lawgivers of the land. And the people are just doing what they think is in the bounds of the law. They think King Noah can kill people, so I can as well. I'm totally lawful here. In fact, it's an unruly environment.
Okay, so that's, like you said, that's sort of laid out the character of the king. So now we get into this guy, Abinadi. It speaks of him coming, and first of all, he comes and he speaks to the people. It came to pass that there was a man among them whose name was Abinadi, and he went forth among them and began to prophesy. So this man who maybe was already in the town, maybe there is a group of people that sort of stayed away from it all, but all we know is there's a man named Abinadi who knows the doctrine, he knows the truth, because yes, it would have taken a long time to build these buildings, to do this wine press, to do all these things, but there'd still be people in the land that were of the generation of King Zeniff, you know? So this isn't a whole new two generations later. This is still, King Noah is still Zeniff's son. So there's still people in the area that remembered everything, that knew right. The way that they were taught. So this Abinadi, he says that, "Thus saith the Lord, he hath commanded me." He's obviously had the Spirit of the Lord speak with him, and he goes forth and says to the people, "Woe unto this people, for I've seen their abominations, their wickedness, and their whoredoms, and except they repent, I will visit them in mine anger." So straight away he's gone to the people saying, this is wrong. The Lord will strike us. The Lord will, show his strength, which he does, all the way through the Book of Mormon. Every time the Nephites forget the Lord, they're always reminded of the Lord because of, the Lamanites sort of come and take over and they're humbled. What I find interesting about Abinadi's story, so this is the first part, again, just speaking to the people. He warns them, quite a few times about what's going to happen to them. And I really like in verse 24, when he says, "Yea, it shall come to pass that when they cry unto me, I will be slow to hear their cries. Yea, I will suffer them that they be smitten by their enemies." Now, this is the Lord. This is the Lord speaking through Abinadi, saying, well, because you've done these wicked things that I've told you not to do, well, when you are being taken over by the Lamanites, well, maybe I'll be slow to remember you if you're slow to remember me. I really like in Doctrine and Covenants where it speaks of this, in Doctrine and Covenants, section 101, Daniel, verse 7 and 8.
Right.
And this says, "And they were slow to hearken unto the voice of the Lord their God. Therefore, the Lord their God is slow to hearken unto their prayers, to answer them in the day of their trouble. In the day of their peace, they esteemed lightly my counsel, but in the day of their trouble, of necessity, they feel after me." Which is so true. I mean, when things are going great, like King Noah, well, things are going great, I don't need the Lord. It's got nothing to do with me, what the Lord has to say. I'm doing all these things of myself. Like you read, it's his own strength. He delights in the bloodshed. Well, then when it comes to, oh no, we need the Lord, well then why wouldn't the Lord straight away answer their prayers?
And that's against the universal laws. You can't just be wicked, 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 and then one thing goes wrong, God, I need your help, and then just expect God to come back in return. That's just simply not how it works. So it makes sense here that Abinadi would be saying, at the very last minute when things go wrong, don't call on the Lord then if you're not willing to call upon him now, because that's simply just not going to happen. Clive, in 25, I like the language that's used. "And except they repent in sackcloth and ashes and cry mightily to the Lord their God, I will not hear their prayers." So again, he's talking about humbling. Unless they repent in sackcloth and ashes, unless they truly mean it, and they only mean it if they have no more options, and so it's just convenient to go to God, or are they actually truly humble and they're trying their meager best, and so they call on God then. And this is what this means here. "Neither will I deliver them out of their afflictions, and thus saith the Lord, and thus hath he commanded me." And then straight away, so what happens? This is verse 26. "Now it came to pass that when Abinadi had spoken these words unto them, they were wroth with him and sought to take away his life." And then it says here, "But the Lord delivered him out of their hands." So as soon as they hear this, they're saying, hang on, you don't know. The laws here are that we can do whatever we like. As long as we pay the king, we can drink, we can party. The people that we look up to are the ones that are letting us do whatever we want. The God that you're talking about wants us to work hard and not do whatever we want and not be free. They don't understand what the laws of God mean. So they immediately get frustrated straight away. They go, well, we don't like what you've got to say, therefore we're going to kill you. That's what's going on in their mind. They love shedding blood. Perfect. We're not going to even barter with you. We're just going to try and kill you and get you out of our way because you're boring us. We don't like what you've got to say. It's an interesting, very quick conversation, I thought, that he's having with the people. And maybe he's in the middle of the town square, or maybe he's just doing a private ceremony. But whoever he's chosen to speak to aren't super stoked that he's there.
Well, it reminds me of 1 Nephi when it says that the wicked take the truth to be hard. And that's what exactly what they've done.
Well, that's this.
Yeah, that is exactly this. So they go and they tell the king that this has happened. And the king, you know, his answer is, well, who is Abinadi? That this is halfway through 27, that I and my people shall be judged of him. Like, who is this guy? And then he says, or who is the Lord that he shall bring upon my people such great affliction? Like, I am the king. Who's the Lord?
Yeah, exactly. Who's the Lord? Don't they know I'm the king? That's crazy.
It is. Imagine being that guy.
He asks, so he says, go get him. And Abinadi takes off, right? Abinadi goes away and he's gone for the space of 2 years. And he essentially lays low, whether he is actually still there for 2 years, but he's just disguised the whole time, or whether he takes off and lives in the forest for a couple of years. But either way, at some stage, he comes back in disguise and floats around the city and it begins to prophesy again. So, you know, you got to think after he's gone for a month, they probably forget about him. But now 24 months later, he's back. And they don't recognize him, I don't imagine. I read something from Hugh Nibley that he thinks when he came back in, they don't really recognize what he's got to say. And he's actually able to talk to them a lot longer here because they don't remember and recognize that this is the same guy from 2 years ago. So he kind of gets a little bit more airtime.
Well, the way I see it, Daniel, I don't know if you see the same way, but when I've been reading this, Abinadi comes the first time and preaches to the people, and then he's gone for 2 whole years. And when he comes back, his preaching, it just seems so different. You know, the wording that he uses, the more he can speak directly from God, I just feel like he's got more authority. Like, to me, I wonder if the 2 years that he's gone, he gets his prophetic calling. Because the Lord says to him in verse 2, stretch forth thy hand and prophesy. So he's saying, it's time to get back out there and you prophesy to these people. And there's no more, I'll prophesy to these people and that's it. And there's no more hiding. This is it. What do you think of that?
His message is definitely more mature and he's very, very knowledgeable. I mean, I've read these chapters now multiple times. He knows his scriptures. He knows his stuff. Thinking from what you've said there, chapter 11, his first coming among the people, it is a basic message where, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, these are complicated, knowledgeable lessons. Maybe he has been. Maybe he got his calling and election made sure in those 2 years, learnt lots. Because he is an important person. Like I said at the start, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have Alma. And if we don't have Alma, we don't have Alma the Younger. And then we don't have Helaman, so on and so on. So Abinadi, it needs credit for the linchpin of the Book of Mormon that he really is. He's not just one of those random stories. Like, if it wasn't for him, the book would end here.
So he comes back and I feel like as we're reading it, it's more of a prophetic way. So he comes back and he gives the people some warnings. Now, I'll just go through them instead of reading all the verses. So in verse 2, the warning that he gives the people that they will be brought into bondage because of the wickedness. They will be killed and vultures and dogs and wild beasts will eat their flesh, which essentially means that when they die, they're not going to be gathered together with their families and buried, and there'll be ceremonies. They'll just be left. They'll be left on the street to die and just to be eaten by vultures, to be carrion for the animals.
It's interesting language, isn't it? That is like, that's such savagery. Like, is he saying that because that's the level they're on? Like, that is some savagery commentary on what's going to happen to their bodies. Like, if that doesn't shock you, I'm not sure anything will shock you.
That's right, yeah. And then he even warns the people about what's going to happen to their king. He says the king that will be valued even as a garment in a hot furnace. So he's prophesying there that the king will die by fire and his value will just be like burning a garment. Nothing. Just throw it in and let it burn.
throw it in, and yeah, 10 seconds later, it's gone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We don't have this big ceremony that the king's going to be killed and let's all gather around and cry about it. It's just throw it in, let it burn. You know, it's very, and these people don't care about each other is what it seems. He then goes on to say that they will have a famine. There'll be a famine, pestilence. They'll howl all day long. You know, I see that as because they're so hungry, you know, constant complaining. It says that they will be burdened, that they'll go around about burdened, which to me, I sort of take this as they won't have any homes anymore. They'll just be wanderers. He says that hail, which is bad for the land and the crops, will come. It'll be so strong, it'll be like they've been smitten with the east wind. Now, it talks about smitten with the east wind a lot in the Bible, which essentially just means it's a wind that's described as it brings great destruction and violence. So it just wipes out anything that it hits. And so because of this, insects will pester the land and devour all the grain. You know, it's really intense prophecies. These are the things that are going to happen to the people because they haven't repented, because they've fallen away so much.
And what's the last thing in verse 8? And it shall come to pass that except they repent, I will utterly destroy them from the face of the earth. And then, of course, they shall leave a record behind them, and I will preserve them for other nations which shall possess the land. Is an interesting point here, Clive. The warning here, and I've got it in green in mind, and I've got all the warnings underlined. The warning here of, except they repent, I'll utterly destroy them, yet they shall leave a record behind them. It's interesting that there's a record needed. Like if you're going to be destroyed, there should be a history. Like we should be able to learn from that and read from that. Like, if you haven't been able to, I guess, bring yourself in line with the Lord, well, the very least you could do is you could be a lesson for other people so we don't make the same mistake as well. And what happens at the end of the Book of Mormon, the Lamanites take over and there's utter destruction and a record is left for us.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, another prophecy. That did confuse me for a while, but yeah, what you're saying does make sense. You know, it just seemed like, why would you try and make them famous if they're so wicked? But yeah, it's for us to learn, you know, like Sodom and Gomorrah. We know all about Sodom and Gomorrah, and that was destroyed. And we know all about it because we know that all the wickedness at Sodom and Gomorrah is something that we need to learn. Well, that's not something that we can do. And it's the same with King Noah's people, I suppose. They turned away and they went the wrong path, even though they've been taught the right way. And I guess that's the record for us to understand. So yeah, it's a good point.
Clive, so now they are angry with him, and I'm not still sure that they know who he is. So so it says here in verse 9, it came to pass that they were angry with him, and they took him and bound before the king, and said unto the king, behold, we have brought a man before thee who has prophesied evil concerning thy people, and saith that God will destroy them. And he also prophesied evil concerning thy life, and say that thy life shall be as a garment in a furnace of fire. It's interesting because they bring him to the king, and they don't just say, listen, this guy's talked bad about us people, because they know the king doesn't care about the people. And if they're bickering amongst themselves, like, what does he care? So that the people are smart enough to say, hey, he hates you as well, and he's talking bad about you. And because he's talking bad about you, you shouldn't cop that. You should do something here. And so they go on and he saith this about you, and he saith that about you, you're going to be trodden underfoot. And they go on. And it's not till we get to 13 where they ask the king a question. It puts the king it puts King Noah in a bit of a difficult spot. They said, and now, O king, what great evil hast thou done? So they're talking to the king. What evil have you done? Or what great sins have we done? What great sins have thy people committed, that we should be condemned of God or judged of this man? Like, hey, we're just dumb people living in the land of Lehi Nephi. What have you done, king, that's made this guy annoyed with us and told us we're going to go to hell? Like, as far as your laws are concerned, we're all living. Like, we're doing everything that we should do. We're paying you our taxes. We're drinking as much as we want. There's no issue here. So what have you done? They put it back on him. And then in 14, and now, O king, behold, we are guiltless, and thou, O king, hast not sinned. Therefore, this man has lied concerning you, and he has prophesied in vain. So it's interesting just that dynamic between the regular common Joes on the street and the way that they're trying to twist the king's arm to get this guy away from them and stop making them feel so guilty. It's an interesting point. And I wonder if around about this stage, does he drop his disguise and they're kind of figuring out here who he is? You know, we don't really see that happening, but I'm imagining that at some stage around about now, his cloak kind of comes off and they end up putting him in prison. In verse 17, it is, Clive, and I don't want to read everything, but in verse 17, now it came to pass that King Noah caused that Abinadi should be cast into prison. Why? Why does he put him into prison here? He commanded that the priests should gather themselves together that he might hold a council with them what he should do with him. So King Noah could easily have just said, hey, kill that guy. Yep, he's super annoying. Take him into the middle of the square and cut his head off. But he must have sparked a little bit of a concern for King Noah to go, well, don't do anything rash yet. He's caused me a bit of stress here. I need to gather my priests together because we got to figure this out. Like, you know I know my father was a righteous person. Am I cooked here? Have we overstepped the boundary? He's having a council going, what should we do?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose in a way, you know, if the king had just killed him straight there and then, the people would have gone, well, is what he was saying was right? And that's why the king had him killed. And so then I guess start questioning the king. So I guess in the king's like, okay, gather the priests together. What do you think's the best way to attack this? Do we just kill him straight away? Well, that will cause these problems. Or if we let him go, he's going to keep prophesying. So what they actually do is they just ask him a ton of questions and try and trip him up. And they say, well, okay, what about this? What does this mean? And what does this mean? And they're just constantly asking him questions. But the great thing about Abinadi and the great thing about having the spirit with you is that you will continue to be able to answer the questions. The gospel questions, they'll always come to your mind. You know, it's always something that I've always strived to do, be able to get to a point in my life where no matter what questions get asked to me, I've always got the right answer. So Abinadi, he does that. You know, there's no way that he can trip him up. But I really like what he has to say in verse 25. So they asked him, you know, what are these things mean? You know, they read from the scripture, say, well, what does this mean? Now, Abinadi said unto them, are you priests and pretend to teach this people and to understand the spirit of prophecy? And yet you desire to know of me what these things mean? So they're going, well, what are you asking me? You call yourselves priests and you're asking me what these things mean. Well, how dare you say that you have that title? You know, if you don't know what it means, why are you asking me? How can you lead this people if you don't even understand the basic doctrine? And I think that's just a great reply. Instead of just going, well, it means this. Next question, it means this. You know, it's a great reply because then it stops them. You know, they're no longer going, okay, well, let's try and trip them up. Now they're going, well, now what?
They try to defend themselves, don't they? And they say, they tell him that they teach the law of Moses. And then Abinadi just goes on an absolute rager. Like, what do you mean you teach the law of Moses? What about this? What about this? What about this? This is verse 29. And again, he said to them, if ye teach the law of Moses, why do ye not keep it? Like, it's a pretty simple question, right? You can imagine them sitting there and this guy who they've sent to prison and pulled him back because it seems like they're at least trying to defend themselves. They could, like I said before, they could have just killed him. They obviously have some guilt inside them and they need to kind of warrant their conversation. They've tried to defend themselves. And he's just going, well, why don't you keep it then? If you know it, why don't you keep it? Why do you set your heart on riches? Why do you commit whoredoms? Why do you and spend your strength with harlots? Yea, and cause this people to commit sin, even a great evil against this people. Know ye not that I speak the truth? Like, ye know that I speak the truth. And you ought to tremble before God. It's a crazy dialogue that Abinadi's having. And like, what about the courage and the strength and the ability in the confidence he has in himself of just going back to them with that? Like, these are people that he must fear, right, on some kind of level.
Well, yeah, exactly. But Abinadi, his wording is just so strong. Like, it's so passionate, you know. He said all those things and he goes really into the Ten Commandments later, but he still sort of brushes on it now. Well, it says to make no other gods before me, but and know the graven images. And I really like in 37, he says, "Now Abinadi said unto them, have ye done all this? I say unto you, nay, ye have not. Have ye taught this people that they should do all these things? I say unto you, nay, ye have not." So, yeah, here's a list of things that the law of Moses that you claim to have taught the people. I'm saying you haven't done them.
Right.
You know, you say you have, I say you haven't. Because here is a clear outline of the law of Moses. You have not done these things. It's such a passionate, strong, you know, it's really the spirit. The spirit is so strong in Abinadi at this point that he has no fear of offending these people.
It's very, he's also happy. He's very happy to accuse them, isn't he? I was just thinking that of 26. I've just got two words underlined in verse 26 over the page. And that's the term that he uses, perverted. I say unto you, woe be unto you for perverting the ways of the Lord. For if ye understand these things, ye have not taught them. Therefore, ye have perverted the ways of the Lord. Like he is a wordsmith. And I just having a thought then about what you said earlier. What happened on these 2 years away? Like he obviously learned a lot. And yeah, was he taught? Did he receive his prophetic call, and was he taught by the Lord? And he obviously knows his scriptures very, very well. He's recalling the scriptures, and he's talking them all off by heart, because it's not like someone's given him a scroll to read from while he's in prison in King Noah's palace. He's just kind of doing this off the top of his head. So he is an incredible person.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe the Lord warned him and said, look, you know, these, you need to prophesy about these things. And, you know, maybe the promise that he gave Joseph Smith, you know, if thou endure it well, God shall exalt thee on high. So yeah, it's not going to be easy, but thou shalt triumph over all thy foes if you do the things that I say. I mean, that'll give you the confidence. No matter what happens to you, you know, as long as you preach to these people the truth and be bold in your words, I will bless you. And I guess that'll just give anyone confidence to do it.
Clive, we got this famous line here where now King Noah's sick of hearing from Abinadi, and he essentially sends guards over, and they want to lay their hands upon him, but Abinadi says, you know, touch me not. But we've covered two chapters, and we've been talking for 40 minutes. I'm just thinking, should we just, we don't want to rush this and try and cram this. This now is where Abinadi, he's glowing. And he really now takes this to town, and he really goes into a lesson. So maybe we should split this up over two parts, and we can actually try to do these last five chapters a bit more justice than just trying to cram them into the end of the episode today.
I agree. And, you know, I look at this and I think good luck to the teachers on Sunday trying to cram all this into one lesson. You know, there's so much to it. So, yeah, all right, let's stop there, and we'll do a part two then.
Okay. Well, thank you for everyone listening. Look out for part two of Abinadi's story. Thank you.